A logo appears in bold slanting letters over a blue planet in space. Turner. Now, in a black and white film, the sign outside a sweeping mansion bears the title, A Selznick Release. Blueprints turn like the pages in a book with credits printed on them in careful lettering. Dor Sherry presents Cary Grant as Jim Blandings, Myrna Loy as Muriel Blandings, and Melvin Douglas as Bill Cole. In Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House, copyright 1948, RKO Radio Pictures Incorporated. This film is described for blind and visually impaired audiences by Descriptive Video Service, WGBH Boston. Described by Samantha Manahan and Robin Sitton. Read by Wendy Sacchichini. Funded by the U.S. Department of Education. For more information about DVS, call toll-free 1-800-333-1203 or write to our email address, dvs@wgbh.org. More titles. An RKO radio production with Reginald Denny, Sharon Moffat, Connie Marshall, Louise Beavers, and Ian Wolfe. Also with Harry Shannon, Tito Vuolo, Nestor Paiva, Jason Robarts, Laureen Tuttle, and Lex Barker. Based on the novel by Eric Hodgins. Director of photography, James Wong Howe. Music by Lee Harline, musical director C. Bakalanikov, gowns by Robert Callop, produced and written for the screen by Norman Panama and Melvin Frank, directed by H.C. Potter. Now our view hovers above a spreading metropolis.
Manhattan. New York. USA. In any discussion of contemporary America and how its people live, we must inevitably start with Manhattan. New York City, USA. Manhattan, glistening modern giant of concrete and steel, reaching to the heavens and cradling in its arms 7 millions. 7 millions. Happy beneficiaries of the advantages and comforts this great metropolis has to offer. Its fine, wide boulevards facilitate the New Yorker's carefree, orderly existence.
A traffic jam clogs downtown for blocks. In a subway station, commuters crowd a train platform.
A transportation system second to none in passenger comfort.
People shove to board.
Quaint little sidewalk cafes make for leisurely, gracious living. For its nature lovers, the peace and privacy of a day in the sun.
Thousands of sunbathers pack a beach.
The city offers delightful changes in climate.
On a snowy day, a man slips on an icy sidewalk. Now a mustached man wearing a fedora smokes a pipe.
I suppose you're wondering what all this has to do with Mr. Blandings and his dream house. Well, I'll tell you. Jim Blandings is part of the fabric of this town. Born and raised right here, he's as typical a New Yorker as anyone you'll ever meet. At least he was. If you want to know the real story, I guess I'm your boy. My name's Cole, Bill Cole. I'm Jim's lawyer and, quote, best friend, unquote. Jim's one of those bright young fellas you see around town. College graduate, advertising business, lovely wife, two fine kids, makes about $15,000 a year. Jim and Muriel Blandings are just like thousands of other New Yorkers. Modern cliff dwellers. The morning it all started was just another of those crisp September mornings. And the Blandings were still asleep.
Our view glides through a high-rise window into the Blandings' bedroom as Jim turns off an alarm clock on a nightstand. Lean-featured with tousled black hair, he rolls his sleeping face away from the clock. His wife turns the alarm back on, then nestles into the pillow of her own twin bed, keeping her eyes closed. Muriel has light, curled hair and delicate features. Jim reaches for the clock again. As his wife gropes for the alarm, Jim slaps her hand away. With her eyes still closed, Muriel steals the clock and holds it beside her, out of Jim's reach. He wearily sits up in his bed, leans across to Muriel's bed, and pries the clock from her fingers. Muriel cracks her eyes open to peek at him.
Yeah.
With a quick glance at the time, 7:30, he returns the clock to the nightstand, then swings his legs over the bed and puts on a pair of slippers. Wearing loose pajamas, he steps over a chaise longue to get to the window, which he closes. On his way across the small room, he takes a long stride, clearing an ottoman in his path. He opens the closet door and holds boxes in place on an upper shelf. While he looks through his suits, something hits him on the head. Jim fumbles around the depths of the dark, cluttered closet and pulls out a frilly dressing gown. In bed, Muriel props herself up on her elbow and watches her husband in the closet. Jim finds his robe on the floor. With his foot, he lifts up the robe and strains to grab it. Holding the frilly dressing gown in one hand and his robe in the other, he steps out of the closet and notices his wife sitting up in bed. She fidgets and looks sheepishly up at him. Calmly meeting her gaze, he tosses her frilly gown aside and closes the closet door. As he strides out of the room, he puts on his striped robe. In the hall, he pauses outside a closed door.
Betsy!
Okay, Dad!
Jim strides down the hall and listens outside another door. Inside, he finds his youngest daughter asleep, curled up on her side. Jim pulls off her covers.
Joan?
Okay, Dad.
Joan slowly sits up, her long dark hair matted from her pillow. In the cozy living room, with a fireplace and bookcase, Jim finds a broom leaning against the sofa. Briefly furrowing his brow, he carries the broom into the dining room, where a birdcage stands in the corner. He removes two towels from the cage, revealing a canary.
No. Morning, Theodore.
A plump black maid greets Jim with a glass of juice.
Good morning, Mr. Blandy.
Morning, Gussie.
She takes the broom and towels into the kitchen. Jim gulps his juice and Gussie brings him a cup of coffee.
Thank you.
Jim, tall and lean, turns sideways to walk around the table and get by the birdcage. Carrying the cup of coffee through the living room, he opens the apartment door and a newspaper falls to the floor. Jim picks it up, glances briefly at the headlines, then tosses it aside. As he strides down the hall, Joan runs out of her room, just missing him. She dashes into the bathroom and Betsy darts out. Jim dodges her. Steam drifts out of the bathroom as he walks into his room. In bed, Muriel sleeps sitting up. Jim tenderly scratches her head, then holds the steaming coffee under her nose.
Thank you.
She cradles the cup in her hands, then takes a sip. Jim rummages through a top drawer of a highboy. He pulls out a pair of undershorts, then searches another drawer.
Looking for something?
My socks.
Why don't you look in your sock drawer?
That's where I found my underwear.
Oh. Well, try your underwear drawer.
I am in my underwear drawer.
He finds a silky negligee. Holding it up, he stares at it quizzically. Muriel draws a deep breath and looks away.
Well, they must be somewhere. Socks don't just get up and walk away by themselves.
Muriel, I thought we had it clearly understood that these two and a half top drawers were mine. I thought,
The closet. That's where they are. We put them in the closet.
Put what in the closet?
Your socks. There didn't seem to be enough room in the drawers.
Oh, and there's so much of it in the closet.
So Gussie and I decided that from now on we'd keep them in a basket on the shelf.
Basket.
Jim opens the closet door and lunges to hold the boxes on the upper shelf in place. Beside them, he finds a basket. He lets go of the boxes and they start to topple. Jim rolls his eyes at the mess, then takes a pair of socks from the basket and restacks the boxes on the upper shelf.
Jim, dear, I do wish you'd try to make a little effort.
I'll try, dear.
He puts a hat box in the closet, then remembers to return the sock basket. Closing the door, he catches the edge of a robe, then opens the door a bit to push the robe inside. With a sigh, he closes a highboy drawer, turns away, then stops. Without looking back, Jim walks into the bathroom. He backs away. Joan comes out.
Father, just one warning. I wish you'd knock.
I beg your pardon.
Joan stalks into her room. Jim heads into the bathroom. Opening his mouth wide, he sticks out his tongue and studies it in the mirror. He takes off his bathrobe, frowns at a few robes already hanging on a hook, then drapes his own robe on top. Scratching his back, he steps on a scale. As Jim stares down, he plants his hands on his hips, then pats his tummy and shakes his head. At the sink, he picks up a tube of toothpaste and frowns. It's been squeezed in the middle. Pressing the bottom of the tube, Jim squishes the toothpaste back up to the top, then squeezes a dollop onto his brush. His toothbrush dangles in his mouth as he screws the cap on the toothpaste, then opens up the medicine cabinet. Stuff spills out. Arching his brow, Jim carefully puts a bottle back on the top shelf. More stuff spills out. He checks the labels on a few of the bottles. Throwing them away, he starts to brush his teeth. Closing the medicine cabinet to bend over the sink, he spits, then splashes water on his mouth. Jim dries his face and looks in the mirror. A deep cleft dimples his stubbly chin. Rolling his lips back in a toothy grin, he checks his bright white teeth. Jim relaxes into a deep breath, takes off his pajama top, then opens the shower door and turns on the water. Behind the door, he takes off his pants, then steps under the streaming water. Later, he shaves at the mirror while Muriel takes a shower.
Washcloth here!
Jim brushes on shaving cream while he gets a washcloth and passes it to her.
Thank you.
She closes the shower door and Jim steps back to the mirror. It's all fogged up. With his hands on his hips, he stares at his blurry reflection, then wipes the fog away with a towel. Now, able to see himself crisply, he thickens the lather on his cheeks.
Towel, dear.
Jim steps into a cloud of steam and hands his wife a towel. Returning to the now foggy mirror, he plants his hands on his hips. Jim wipes the steam from the mirror again. White shaving cream covers his face like a beard. Later, Muriel brushes her teeth at the sink. Jim shaves, craning his neck to see over her. He swings open the mirrored medicine cabinet for a better view, then closes it so she can get around him. She puts her toothbrush in a holder and blocks Jim's view. Cocking her head, she studies her smooth complexion. Jim, half-shaved, tilts his head and jockeys for position.
If you don't mind, dear.
One moment.
While she looks in the medicine cabinet, Jim touches the skin over his lip.
Take your time. I can spare the blood.
Did you cut yourself?
I cut myself every morning. I kind of look forward to it.
Why don't you use an electric razor?
Can't get used to them.
Oh, that's silly. Bill Cole's been using one for years.
He hasn't got my beard.
Ah. Bill's beard is just as coarse and
tough. I am not interested in discussing the grain and texture of Bill Cole's hair follicles before I've had my breakfast.
All I said was, why don't you use an electric razor?
Because I prefer the clean sweep of the tempered steel as it glides.
No advertising copy, please. And hurry up. Yeah. You'll be late for breakfast.
Sure.
Later at the breakfast table, Jim sits by Theodore the Canary, sipping coffee as he reads the newspaper. He turns the page and finds a square cut out.
Who did it? Yes?
I did.
Haven't I repeatedly told you not to cut up the morning paper until I've had a chance to look at it?
I'm sorry, Father. It's necessary research.
What's that, another Miss Stellwagen's so-called progressive projects?
Coming through, Theodore.
Say, does Theodore have to have breakfast with us? Can't you take him into the living room?
Gussie squeezes by Betsy.
Dear, there just isn't any point in sending your children to an expensive school if you're going to undermine the teacher's authority in your own dining.
I'm not undermining anything. I'm in the advertising business, and keeping abreast of the times is important to me.
So is your children's education.
Well, that's not the point.
It certainly is.
Not.
Baker, baker, baker.
You drink your milk.
Joan, every time your father and I have a lively discussion, we aren't necessarily bickering. What is it, Betsy? Another English composition?
Miss Delwagon has assigned each of us to take a classified ad and write a human interest theme about it. I found one typical of the disintegration of our present society.
I wasn't aware of the fact our society was disintegrating.
I didn't expect you to be, Father. Miss Delwagon says that middle-class people like us are all too prone to overlook...
Muriel, I know this is asking a lot, but just one morning I would like to sit down and have breakfast without social significance.
Jim, you really must take more interest in your children's education.
Can't squeeze blood from a turnip.
Taken aback, Jim glances at Joan.
All right. I listen. Shoot.
It's 16 words. I'm going to call it a minor tragedy of our time.
Betsy opens her notebook.
Well?
Forced to sell. Farm dwelling. Original beams. Barn. Apple orchard. Trout stream. Seclusion. Superb view. Will sacrifice.
Go on.
That's all.
That's all?
You don't see it, do you, Father?
No, a fellow wants to sell his house, so he puts an ad in the paper. What did you expect him to do, take it to the United Nations?
There must be more to it than that, isn't there, dear?
Certainly, Mother. What some people don't see is the whole sordid picture. A poor, honest farmer pushed to the wall by hardship until finally, in desperation, he's forced to sell and stoops to the crass commercialism of newspaper advertising.
Oh, dear. Newspaper advertising. Crass commercialism, huh?
Miss Delwagon says advertising is a basically parasitic profession.
You don't say.
Miss Delwagon says advertising makes people who can't afford it buy things they don't want with money they haven't got.
Oh, she does she? Well, perhaps your Miss Delwagon is right. Perhaps I should quit this basically parasitic profession, which at the very moment is paying for your fancy tuition and those extra French lessons. And that progressive summer camp. To say nothing of the very braces on your back teeth.
Jim, I wish you wouldn't discuss money in front of the children.
Why not? They spend enough of it.
Bicker, bicker, bicker.
Uh-huh. Girls, get your things and run along. You'll be late for school.
They kiss Jim goodbye.
Bye, Daddy.
Give my regards to Miss Stellwagen.
Joan puts on her hat.
I'll get it!
She opens the door.
Oh, hello!
Hey,
we haven't seen you.
Morning,
Bill. Oh,
Betsy, is your mother up?
Down! Down! Come on!
Down.
Wait! Down!
Bye.
The girls run out.
Morning, Muriel.
Good morning, Bill.
Hi, Jim.
Hello, Bill.
Thought you were going out to Lily and Paul's for the weekend.
Yeah, I am. They'll pick me up in a few minutes. But I thought I'd better return these in case you want to go through with that Funkhauser deal. Oh.
He gives her a portfolio.
Thanks.
Cup of coffee, Bill?
Yeah, thanks, I will.
Gussie.
Personally, I think he's $2,000-$3,000 out of line.
Yes, I suppose so.
Of course, you could save that amount by not tearing out the living room wall. That's sort of impractical anyway.
Hey. I guess so.
Hmm? What wall? Who are you talking about? Who's Funkhauser?
Thanks.
Bunny Funkhauser.
Who?
You remember Bunny Funkhauser, dear. That clever young interior decorator we met at the Collins cocktail party?
You mean that young man with the open-toed sandals? What about him?
Well, you know how long we've said we've got to do something about fixing up this apartment. Well, a couple of weeks ago he called, and I asked him to come over, and he had some simply wonderful ideas. And I didn't want to bother you with sketches and estimates until I knew whether we could afford it. So I sent them over to Bill.
Mm-hmm. How much?
What's the point in asking how much until you know what you're going to get?
I've seen Bunny Funkhauser. I know what I'm going to get.
Well, personally, I think he's got some fairly interesting sketches.
He's terribly clever. Look, here's how he sees our living room. Isn't it charming?
What's that, a shoeshine stand?
It's a cobbler's bench, dear. Mm. The room's colonial. Break front. Hooked rug, student lamp, pie cooler, and over here's a Martha Washington desk.
And where do I keep my powdered wig?
I think it's perfect. It's us. Bunny says we're very American, very grassroots,
Very blueberry pie.
Jim smiles tightly at Bill.
Well, don't look at me. Bunny said it.
Now, you're in the hall.
How much is all this going to cost?
Well, the figure isn't really accurate because it includes...
How much?
Well, $7,000, Jim, but...
$7,000?
Well, that includes tearing out a wall. And I quite agree with Bill that...
Oh, you do? You're some lawyer. A defenseless woman without the slightest conception of the value of a dollar comes to you for advice, and the next minute you've got her tearing out walls.
I am on record as being opposed to tearing out walls, and so is the woman.
If you'd only listen...
$7,000? I wouldn't put 7 cents into this broken-down rat trap.
Jim, how can you talk that way? This is our home. Betsy was practically born in this apartment.
That does not make it a national shrine.
Now, wait a minute. When I came in here this morning, I had no intention of sending you two to Reno. I thought I was doing you a favor.
And he was. He was showing you how you could save $3,000 by simply not tearing out a wall.
I can save $7,000 by not doing anything at all.
Yeah, you can save another $3,500 by not buying her that mink coat. And if you don't take that cruise to the West Indies...
All right, Bill, all right.
Not a bad day. You've already saved $15,000 and it's not even 9 o'clock. See you next week. Bye, Jim. Bye, dear.
Have a nice weekend.
Wait, I'll go down with you.
What?
$7,000. Blueberry pie. Oh.
Jim opens a closet and junk falls out. Later in his office, his secretary stares at a model ham shank.
Morning, Mary.
Morning.
What's that?
Seems we're in the midst of a situation.
Huh?
W-H-A-M, wham. A whale of a ham.
Well, what's it doing here? That's Johnson's headache.
Not anymore. Mr. Johnson is no longer with us. Mr. Johnson lost the touch. And guess whose headache it is now?
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
Oh, no.
On your desk, you will find a directive from the High Command.
What a morning. Bunny Funkhauser, blueberry pie, and wham.
How's that?
Oh, nothing, Mary. Just a private joke between me and whoever's going to be my analyst.
They sent down some of Mr. Johnson's handiwork before he was drummed from the Corps. July. When you've got the whim, say wham. Mm. August, house and stream. For a grand slam in ham, try wham. I have some more over here.
Balance of last year's campaign. September's a little gem that cost him his job.
A magazine ad catches Jim's eye. Come to peaceful Connecticut.
Mary, would you spend $7,000 to tear out someone else's walls when for a few thousand more you could find a nice old place in Connecticut, fix it up, and have the kind of dream house you've always wanted?
I beg your pardon.
Later, Jim drives his convertible.
Well, that's the way it all started. The ad was enough to convince Jim.
His wife joins him.
But Muriel was a little tougher. I guess the corsage did it.
An older, jug-eared man joins them.
There they are. Two little fish from New York out in the deep, deep waters of Connecticut real estate. That's Smith, the real estate salesman. Mighty shrewd cookie in a quiet sort of way. Yes, sir, he knows a sucker. I mean, customer, when he sees one.
Jug-eared Smith looks over at Jim.
He sees one. Well, Smith, looks like you're finally going to unload the old Hackett place. The old, very old Hackett place.
They drive up to a rickety farmhouse.
Well, folks, there she is.
It's charming. That is for an old house.
Of course you understand, Mr. Smith. We're just window shopping, so to speak. Nothing definite.
Oh, perfectly all right.
They get out.
Not a bad-looking house. But it's a lot older than anything we had in mind.
Well, she's no spring chicken. But that's just what makes her such a buy. Yeah, man's got just about everything you need here. Nice big hay barn.
Skinny birch trees thrive.
Couple of fruit orchards just over the hill. Virgin stand okra over the side of the trout stream there. The trout stream will give you your own pure, clear, cold mountain water. Paved highway right to your door. Grocer from town delivers twice a week. Easy commuting distance. Yeah, 58 minutes from New York City. Brand new high school right down the road. Yes, sir. 50 mighty pretty little acres. Fine old house, too. 4 family bedrooms, plenty of closet space.
Jim brightens.
However, it's not just all these, you know. You're buying a piece of American history.
You don't say. How's that?
Why, first year she was built, General Gates stopped right here to water his horses.
Old General Gates, huh? Civil War.
Huh? Revolutionary War.
Oh, that General Gates.
Well, I'm not trying to sell you anything, understand? All I'm saying is that one of these days, someone with a little imagination is going to come along and just steal this place. And I mean steal it. Guess I don't have to tell you, Mrs. Blandings, what a woman's touch could do to a place like this.
She imagines a quaint house, beautifully landscaped, with curving garden beds in full bloom. She strolls the yard picking flowers. Muriel blinks away the dream.
Yes, sir. You've certainly got to visualize. A couple coats of paint, a little pointing up here and there.
Jim imagines a stately house. Beside a Great Dane, he stands on the front walk, cradling a shotgun and smoking a pipe. Smiling at the old farmhouse, Jim puts his arm around Muriel.
Shall we go up and take a look at it?
Well, I suppose as long as we're here.
I guess it doesn't hurt to take a look.
Jim escorts his wife up an overgrown slope.
I'll just see if the keys are up there where I left them.
Smith runs ahead.
It does have possibilities. You think we can get it?
Like taking candy from a baby.
Now, don't lose your head.
Now, you just keep quiet, dear, and let me handle this. Tell me, Smith, what kind of price is the owner asking for this old place?
The agent bangs open the stuck door and heads inside. Two doves fly out an upstairs window. Later, the Blandings meet with Bill Cole.
What do you think, Bill? Steal, huh?
Steal's an understatement. Swindle might be a little more appropriate.
Oh, well, what do you mean?
Every time you get tight, you weep on my shoulder about the advertising business. How it forces a sensitive soul like yourself to make a living by bamboozling the American public. Well, I would say that a small part of that victimized group has now redressed the balance.
What are you talking about?
You. You've been taken to the cleaners and you don't even know your pants are off.
Darling, I told you, I said we ought to call Bill.
Now, Muriel. All right, just what's wrong with this deal?
First time round, you offered $10,000 for 50 acres, right?
What of it?
That's $200 an acre. I know that part of Connecticut. $100 an acre is standard top gouge price to city slickers. When the natives sell to each other, it's around 40 or less.
40?
The man's entitled to a fair profit.
Not 284%. Besides, you're not getting 50 acres. You're only getting 35, more or less.
Where does it say that?
I refer to a rather obscure postscript on the back of the second letter from friend Smith.
Bill shows it to Muriel.
Incidentally, Mr. Hackett has been a little optimistic about the acreage. It will probably survey somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 acres, more or less.
All right, so it's 35. What's the difference? Do you know how many tennis courts you can get on 35 acres?
You're not spending $11,500 for tennis courts.
That's not the point.
That's precisely the point. We're going to write this fellow Hackett a strong letter. Tell him he can either kick in with those 15 acres, reduce the price, or find another sucker.
We'll do no such thing. I'm not going to queer this deal over 15 broken down acres. You just don't understand business.
You mean extortion.
Now, wait a minute. Now, put that thing down. Look, you can't measure everything on a slide rule. This house has certain intangibles.
Like what, for instance?
Like antique value, for instance. It just so happens that General Gates stopped right there, that very house, to water his horses.
I don't care if General Grant dropped in for a scotch and soda. You're still getting rooked.
That was a different war.
I think Bill's absolutely right.
Now, let me explain something to both of you. For 15 years, I've been cooped up in a four-room cracker box. Just getting shaved in the morning entitles a man to the Purple Heart.
That still doesn't make this a good buy.
Bill, Muriel and I have found what I'm not ashamed to call our dream house.
It's like a fine painting. You buy it with your heart, not your head. You don't ask how much was the paint, how much was the canvas. You look at it, and you say, it's beautiful, I want it. And if it costs a few more pennies, you pay it, and gladly, because you love it. And you can't measure the things you love in dollars and cents. Oh, well, anyway, that's the way I feel about it. And when I sign those papers on Saturday, I can look the world in the face and say, it's mine, my house, my home, my 35 acres.
His wife stands up and turns him to face her.
Our house, our home, our 35 acres.
They share a tender kiss.
More or less.
Later, a country road leads up to a covered wooden bridge.
So Jim cashed in his government bonds, gave old man Hackett a $6,000 mortgage, and bought the place. Then they drove me out to see him.
This certainly isn't the way we came with Mr. Smith.
What in the world are shrunk mills?
Probably mills that have shrunk.
Seems to me we go left.
Over the bridge and turn right.
Left.
Jim drives the convertible across the bridge. On the other side, he sticks his arm out, then turns left. Later, they pass a stone wall and a stand of slender birches, then roll up to the covered bridge again. A sign just below the roof reads, Shrunk Mills, 2 miles.
Congress ought to pass a law. When a man buys a house in Lansdale County, there's a prize. He gets 10% off if he can find it.
Over the bridge and turn right.
Left.
Jim backs up the rounded black convertible, then turns left down another dirt road. They drive through the rolling countryside and end up back where they started. In the passenger seat, Muriel throws her husband a sidelong glance. Bill leans forward in the back seat.
You know, if you really want to find that house of yours, it's no problem. Just pretend that you're one of General Gates' horses and you're very thirsty. Where would you go for a drink of water?
Jim puts the car in drive and crosses the bridge. At the fork, Muriel sticks her right arm out, and Jim makes a right turn. Later, they pull into the driveway of the old Hackett place, their new home. The left side of the rundown house is lower than the right. The roof sags, the windows have broken panes, and the siding is cracked. Jim gets out of the car and turns his wide smile on Bill.
Well, I must admit, it's a very beautiful thing.
The house and the lilac bush at the corner are just the same age, Bill. If a lilac can live and be so old, so can the house. It just needs someone to love it, that's all.
Shingles fall off the roof.
It's a good thing there are two of you, one to love it and one to hold it up.
Frowning, Jim narrows his eyes on Bill.
What did your engineer say when he checked the foundation in that roof?
Now, who needs engineers? This isn't a train, you know.
I just saw it move.
This house has been standing since the second year of the Continental Congress. You take one look at it and shingles start to fall off.
Look, let me do you a favor. I've got a client, Crackerjack structural engineer, Joe Apollonio.
Frankly built the George Washington Bridge single-handed.
Thanks a lot, but we're not building a bridge.
He's the fellow who advised the government not to raise the Normandy. They didn't listen to him, cost him $5 million.
You have my word. If I were raising the Normandy, I wouldn't make a move without Apollonio. Now, would you like to come in and look around?
No, thanks.
Jim heads inside alone, wearing a crisp pinstripe suit. Muriel gets out.
Muriel!
I think you'd better get in touch with Mr. Apollonio.
Later, the Blandings bring out the engineer.
The house has charm, hasn't it, Mr. Apollonio?
Mm-hmm. Of course, any small changes would have to conform to the character of the countryside.
Yeah. And still be functional.
What is your professional opinion?
The heavyset engineer puffs on a cigar and glances at the house.
Tear it down.
Tear it down?
If your sills was shut and your timbers was okay, I'd say go ahead, fix her up. If your timbers was shut and your sills was okay, again, I'd say go ahead and fix her up. But your sills are shut, and your timbers are shut. I assure you.
He levels a picture frame on a barrel.
Take a look at the way what she leans.
They stare through the rectangular frame at the ramshackle house, listing to the right. Jim tilts the picture frame.
Well, it has to be level.
Oh.
So I say don't throw good money after bad. Tear it down. Good day.
He tips his derby and strolls off, puffing smoke.
Thanks a lot.
That's okay. And I send my bill to your office.
Bill Cole and his experts.
Never mind, darling. We'll get our own experts.
And so they got their own experts. Mr. Simpson said,
tear it down.
On the other hand, Mr. Murphy said,
tear it down.
And that's how our friend Mr. Sims came into it.
An architect.
He said, of course, it was possible to fix up the old place, but why not build a new house, same size? Certainly wouldn't cost any more. Why not look at a floor plan?
Yeah, something like this. First floor, living room, dining room, study, kitchen, breakfast room, service ports, maid rooms. Upstairs, three family bedrooms with two adjoining baths.
Well, it's very nice. But don't you think it's a little conventional?
Mm. Yes, Mr. Sims. Of course, if we were going to build a house, we'd want it, just a little bit different.
Oh, yes, yes. Of course, this is just a point of departure. You don't have to adhere to any of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think we're at all ready to commit ourselves.
Oh, no.
Of course not. I understand.
Well,
perfectly.
If this were my house, I'd...
Jim picks up a pencil and studies the floor plans.
Now here, for instance.
He redraws the first floor, expanding the living room.
Now, in the study, if we could just push out this wall a little and put in a built-in bar...
Excuse me, dear. Huh? These bedrooms are too small, and we'll have to have a little dressing room.
Yeah, and closets, Mr. Sims. Plenty of closets. If there's one thing this family needs, it's closets.
Yes, if I might make a suggestion.
And bathrooms, Mr. Sims. Each bedroom must have at least one bathroom. Yeah,
but that would be four bathrooms, Mrs. Blandings.
Yeah.
I think I'd better point out to you.
I was wondering. Look, do you think we could manage a little playroom in the basement? You know, nothing tremendous, just, something like this.
Well, of course, it's always possible. But at the moment, our fundamental problem...
And I've always wanted a little sewing room. A little utility room upstairs where I could be alone and sew or sulk on a rainy afternoon.
Yeah, pardon me, dear. Now, Mr. Sims, about that playroom, not too small, you know, plenty of room for a darts, ping pong, nice big poker table.
Yes, if you don't mind...
And off the kitchen,
and I think,
now, a little flower.
Yes, see, there should be a terrace off the study with a little awning and an outdoor fireplace.
And shelves for vases,
sort of a barbecue
and a
thing, you know,
gardening things.
What do they call it? Roasting thing. Rotisserie thing.
Oh.
Yeah, for Sunday afternoon. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Sims looks at the redrawn floor plans.
Well, let's see what we have here.
He takes a breath and frowns.
In the first place, I'm afraid...
Jim and Muriel draw their own plans.
In the first place, I'm afraid you've got the upstairs about twice as big as the downstairs.
It's all those bathrooms.
It's all those closets.
By extending that breakfast room, you've eliminated the possibility of any stairs going up to the second floor.
Well, I've allowed for that. You can put them in behind the pantry.
Mr. Sims looks over Muriel's shoulder.
Mrs. Blandings, on that sewing room, the way you have it there, the chimney stack would come right up through the middle of the room, leaving you with something in the shape of a square doughnut. Which, of course, might be very warm in winter, but otherwise of doubtful utility.
Can't you put the chimney somewhere else?
Look, I think I know just about what you two have in mind. Suppose I go ahead with some preliminary plans, and then we can get together in about a week's time.
All right, you do that.
Bye.
Jim eyes his watch.
Holy smoke!
Oh, I'm afraid we didn't realize.
Well, Mr. Sims, don't you forget, we've got to hold it down under 10,000.
That, I can tell you right now, is impossible. Even with considerable trimming of the things that you've indicated, I don't see how we can bring it in for less than 12 or 12,500.
12,500? Oh, well, I guess we're not going to quibble about a few pennies one way or the other.
Oh, by the way, have you any notions as to how you'd like the old place taken down?
Oh, why don't we just blow on it?
Later, a bulldozer pulls over the stone chimney of the rundown farmhouse. Jim and Muriel, bundled against the cold, watch the raising.
Well, so far it's cost us $13,329.45.
She takes his arm.
But we have the nicest vacant lot in the state of Connecticut.
Later, Joan and Betsy eavesdrop on their parents and Mr. Sims.
Well, something will have to be cut. These plans are just too elaborate for the money you have to spend.
All right. I'll make the sacrifice. You can cut it out.
No, we're that's getting something.
What's happening? Dad just lost his playroom.
Muriel, as the house stands now, it's over $15,000.
Mother, may we please put Theodore to bed?
Yes. It just doesn't seem possible for a house with such small rooms.
Mrs. Brandings, I've already explained. It's not so much the size of the rooms as it is the number. Now, is it absolutely essential for each of your daughters to have her own room with two closets and a private bath?
Yes. You see, my daughters are approaching womanhood, and...
I didn't realize they were approaching it quite so fast. Perhaps what you need is not so much a house as a series of little bungalows, each with two closets and a private bath.
Well, what about that silly flower sink? We could lose that.
I beg your pardon?
Oh, that sewing room, that's certainly a waste.
May I suggest that neither of these are really major eliminations. Now, if you could do with one less bathroom...
I'm sorry, we couldn't possibly.
A simple bathroom, 8x10x8, with grade A fixtures, will cost around $1,300.
I refuse to endanger the health of my children in a house with less than four bathrooms.
For $1,300, they can live in a house with three bathrooms and rough it.
Now, Bill Cole hurries to the Blandings' apartment and presses the doorbell.
Hello, Muriel. Well, you've done it again. Once. Just once. Why don't you come to me and find out if it's all right, if it's legal, before you go barging off and run yourself smack into another jam?
What's eating you?
I must say, Sims, I hold you equally responsible.
What? What happened?
I'm afraid I don't understand.
Did you let this idiot tear down that house?
What if he did? What of it?
Reconstruction was unsound and totally impractical.
I quite agree, but you're dealing with a man who doesn't think before he acts, who goes off half-cocked.
What is it? What did I do?
You're an architect. You must have been aware of the legality involved.
What? What legality?
You knew there was a mortgage on that house.
I assumed as much.
What happened? What are you talking about?
What did you do?
I don't know. They won't tell me.
Certainly, but since you were his lawyer, I naturally assumed.
With a guy like this, you don't assume anything.
Now, just a minute. I'm entitled to know what I did. This is America. A man is guilty until he's proven innocent.
It's the other way around, Father.
You go to bed.
Girls.
Bill, would you mind telling me in clear, concise English just what crime I've committed and why?
In clear, concise English, you tore down a house on which another man holds a mortgage without first getting his written permission.
Well, I did.
And in such case, the mortgagee can demand full payment of said mortgage. Mr. Ephemus Hackett so demands. 6,000 clams. And he wants them now.
Now?
You've got 10 days.
Miss Stellwagen says the problems of the parents should be the problems of the children.
Well, you keep that in mind, dear. It'll help prepare you for motherhood.
Perhaps we'd better let the plans go for the time being.
No, Sims, I'll work this out. You go ahead with your final plans and let's see some estimates.
Very well. You'll hear from me as soon as possible. Good night. Good night, Mr. Cole.
Good night.
$6,000.
Good night, Mr. Sims.
Good night, Mrs. Blandings.
What are you going to do about the collateral on your building loan?
I don't know. Turning my insurance policies or something.
Jim, you can't do that.
Why not?
Why, if anything should happen, the children would be left unprotected.
I'm not dead yet.
Well, of course you're not.
I'll see the boys at the bank. Maybe you can put up your insurance as collateral. If necessary, I'll sign a personal note.
Thanks, Bill.
Well, I gotta run along. Jim, do me a little favor, will you? The next time you're gonna do anything or say anything or buy anything, think it over very carefully. When you're sure you're right, forget the whole thing.
Muriel hands Bill his overcoat and fedora.
Good night, Muriel.
Good night, Bill.
Jim watches Bill kiss his wife's cheek before leaving. Muriel fluffs the sofa pillows.
What a wonderful friend.
What's with all this kissing all of a sudden?
What's that?
Well, just because a man is helpful in a business way doesn't give him extracurricular privileges with my wife.
Well, that's a fine thing to say about a friend of 15 years.
Well, I just don't like it. Every time he goes out of this house, he shakes my hand and he kisses you.
Would you prefer it the other way around?
Well, why is he always hanging around? Why doesn't he ever get married or something?
He because he can't find another girl as pretty and sweet and wholesome as I am.
Muriel waves her hand in front of Jim's faraway gaze, then drapes her arms around his neck.
Oh, darling, let's not be silly about this. It isn't Bill. It's the house that's upsetting you.
I suppose so. Do you think it's worth all this?
Of course it is. It isn't a house we're building. It's a home. For ourselves and our children. And maybe our children's children.
They nuzzle cheeks.
Each with two closets and a private bath.
Their smiles meet in a kiss. Later in Mr. Sims' office.
Well, here are the estimates. But before you look at them, I think I better explain.
Oh, don't bother, Mr. Sims. We're getting to be old hands at this sort of thing.
The Blandings study a list of bids. Gaping, they stand up and sigh.
Of course, these bids are obviously way out of line. That is all except John Retton's son at $21,000.
$21,000?
And with some judicious cutting, I think we could pare that down to $18,000.
But we've only asked for the barest necessities.
Frankly, with all the extras that you two have...
Never mind, Mr. Sims. If you'll send us a bill for your services, I'll see it's taken care of. Goodbye, Mr. Sims.
Oh, but one moment. Mr. Blanding's in the first place.
Now, in the first place, Mr. Sims, I am going out to get my head examined. Then if I don't jump off the Brooklyn Bridge, I'm going to find the owner of our apartment building and sign a 20-year lease. Goodbye.
Goodbye, sir.
Goodbye, Mr. Sims.
Goodbye, Mrs. Blanding's.
On the way out, Muriel sees a watercolor painting of the proposed house with two chimneys and shuttered windows. A caption labels it the residence of Mr. and Mrs. James Blandings. Henry L. Sims, architect. Jim brings Muriel's fur coat over. His clear, dark eyes tighten on the painting. Trees, grass, and gardens fill the spacious yard. Jim and Muriel turn longingly to each other, then to Mr. Sims.
Do you think you could keep it down to 18,000?
Later on the Connecticut property, a professionally printed sign reads John W. Retch and Son Contractors. A crudely painted board above it reads Blanding's Job. A bulldozer crawls over roughly graded ground past carpenters and a dump truck filled with dirt. Jim helps Muriel step over a rut in the ground as they cross the property with Bill Cole. A steam shovel swings its bucket arm over their heads. Jim grins happily.
Well, things are certainly humming.
What?
I said humming.
Bill nods blankly and chomps his pipe.
Oh, there's my contractor, Mr. Retch. I'll introduce you.
We heard that stuff over a month ago. Get down to the
payoff. Hello, Mr. Retch.
Hi.
Retch passes without stopping.
Put a lot on his mind.
The steam shovel driver scowls.
Hey, get out of the way. You want to get killed?
They duck from the swinging bucket as it passes over their heads. Jim sends a saluting wave to an old man in galoshes.
What's going on over there?
Oh, that's Mr. Tassander. He's digging our well.
Tassander sits above a hole on the rim of a drilling rig.
How long does that go on?
3 weeks now, at $4.50 a foot.
Right.
I think I'd better have a little talk with Mr. Tassander.
Tassander, in a tattered cardigan and summer hat, stares into the hole. Jim approaches behind him.
Mr. Tassander!
Tassander yanks a lever.
Yep.
How's it coming?
It's coming.
Mr. Tassander!
He squints at Jim.
Yep.
What I meant was, how far down are you?
Oh, about 130 feet.
Isn't that pretty deep?
Yeah.
I mean, do you think perhaps you ought to try another spot?
Up to you.
Well, haven't you hit anything yet at all?
Hit some limestone yesterday.
That's good?
That's bad. Right now, looks like we're coming into some shale.
That's bad?
That's good.
Oh.
Of course, it might turn out to be sandstone.
That's bad.
Can't tell. Might be good, might be bad. One thing you know, you got plenty shale, sandstone, and limestone.
I see.
Mr. Sander.
How do you do?
How do you do? Just for the record, of course, what happened to water?
Oh, it's there, all right. Just got to be patient.
In a nearby ditch, the steam shovel driver angrily points his finger.
What's wrong with the steam shovel?
Muriel gets stuck on a dirt pile.
Jim!
Bill takes her hands and steadies her. She curtsies.
Thank you.
Passing Jim, she glares. The shovel driver looks at a waist-high rock.
What's the matter, Mr. Zucker? Something wrong?
How do you like that? I broke my bucket. Two times this week I broke my bucket.
What did you do, hit a boulder?
That's no boulder. It's a ledge.
What does that mean?
Means we got a blast.
Blast?
Blast with dynamite.
What do you mean, dynamite?
What do you mean, what do you mean? Mr. Zucker explained he has to use dynamite to blast to get rid of the rock.
That's no rock, that's a ledge.
Well, what Mr. Blandings means is, what precisely is a ledge?
A ledge is like a big stone, only it's bigger.
Like a boulder?
No, like a ledge.
Like a ledge.
But you don't have to worry. It only costs $6 a cubic yard, plus the dynamite and the fuse.
How far will you have to blast?
Hard to tell. Might be a little baby ledge, might run the whole top of the mountain.
At $6 a yard, you realize what that means?
Means we got the blast.
Later in his office, Jim props his feet up and talks with his secretary, Mary.
With a few minor deviations, I know exactly where every penny is going.
Is that all?
Yes, thanks.
She sticks her pencil in her hair.
Hi.
Oh, Bill, come in.
I've just been going over the NAP contracts with old man Dascom. While I was in there with Dascom, the conversation kind of got around to you.
Oh, what is it?
Well, he didn't say in so many words that ever since you started fooling around with that house, you haven't come up with one acceptable slogan.
But...
Bill looks what? Through Jim's desk.
Where is it?
It's there.
He finds a can of tobacco.
But since the Wham account is the backbone of this agency, I kind of felt that... He kind of felt that if I kind of told you that you'd know that he knew that you knew or something.
Well, what's he worrying about? The deadline is 6 months off.
Jim switches on a desk intercom.
Yeah?
Mrs. Blandings calling from Lansdale.
Okay. Yes, Muriel? What? What? Tazander struck water? Say, that's wonderful! Bill, we've got our well.
Congratulations.
What? What's that? What do you mean we've got two wells? Oh. Oh. I'll be right out. Come on, Bill.
In Connecticut, water bubbles from Tassander's well casing. A few feet away, a work crew shovels a path for more water flowing downhill toward the spewing well. The Blandings, Bill and Henry Sims, watch the crew from across the flooded foundation hole. Retch holds a 6-foot measuring stick.
So you hit a spring, a bubbling spring, right here in our cellar.
It'll have to be diverted before Retch here can pour his cement.
May take a while. Pumps are over in Jersey.
Tassander clasps his hands behind his back and shakes his head.
Water, Mr. Tassander.
Yep.
At 6 feet.
Yep.
And just over there, you had to go down 227 feet to hit the same water.
Yeah.
Now, how'd you account for that, Mr. Tassander?
Well, the way it appears to me, Mr. Blandings, over here, the water is down around 6 feet. And over there, it's down around 227 feet.
Bill.
Yeah.
Later, Rich's crew powers up a pump, then tosses its drainage hose into the flooded pit. Water sprays from the discharge line, quickly draining the pit. Later, carpenters in overalls build a wooden foundation form. A length of string marks a level plane. Rich's men unload bags of dry concrete from a flatbed truck, then dump it into a mixing drum. The dark, wet mixture pours into the narrow foundation forms. As construction continues, the house's shape develops. Three men raise a wall frame of wooden studs and braces. Later, the upper story frame appears. Later still, Bill tours the frame structure with the Blandings. They stand in a doorway wide enough for four men.
What's this, another closet?
This happens to be our living room.
This isn't the living room, John. The living room's across the hall.
Well, they made the dining room.
Well, I think it's,
Maybe it's this little room here.
No, that's the breakfast room.
That isn't the breakfast room, that's the powder room.
Oh.
Just where is the dining room?
Right here a minute ago.
Jim reads the blueprints like a map.
Couldn't just have lost it.
Two carpenters sit above them.
You know, I don't get this guy Blandings at all. If you got a bill in the windiest hill in Connecticut, why does he have to pick the windiest side of the hill?
You know those New York millionaires. Easy come, easy go.
Bill and Muriel grin as they walk to the next room.
Now here is the living room, right?
Yes. There's the fireplace.
Come right in.
After you, Rockefeller.
Hey, mister, you're the owner here, aren't you?
Yeah?
Just the man I want to see.
I'll browse around upstairs.
An athletically built foreman comes down a ladder in front of Jim.
On them second floor littles between the lally columns. Do you want we should rabbit them or not?
Jim stares at him.
The second floor lallies?
Second floor lintels between the lallies.
Jim casually waves his pipe.
Oh, the lintels between the lallies.
Yeah, from the blueprints you can't tell. You want they should be rabbited?
Muriel glances from Jim to the foreman.
No, I guess not.
Okay, you're the doctor. Hey, fellas! You got any of them rabbited lintels set? Rip them out!
He climbs back up the ladder. Blocks of grooved wood rain over the Blandings.
It sounded less expensive to say no.
The whole crew files out wearing their hats.
Now look what you've done.
Jim pushes through them.
Oh, look, men! Mrs. Blandings didn't mean anything. I mean, there's no point in walking off a job just because a woman makes a silly little remark.
Look, mister, it's Saturday. We quit at 12 o'clock.
Oh. Unless you want us to go on overtime.
No. Very kind of you, I'm sure, but, see you Monday, fellas.
Jim's broad grin fades. Muriel holds onto a wall stud and frowns.
I'm sick. From the outside, this place looks like a grain elevator. On the inside, everything's miles too small.
Mm-hmm.
What's that?
Hmm? What's wrong?
That noise. It's upstairs.
Jim and Muriel climb the wooden staircase with slow and even steps. They stand before a closed door scrawled with the words, "Keep out, storeroom." Jim opens it to reveal Bill dropping a nail barrel against the bare floor.
What happened?
The door blew shut. I got locked in.
Impossible. I had this closet built especially for myself. The lock opens from the inside.
Maybe for Houdini. Not for me.
Nothing to it. A child could do it. Look, I'll show you.
Shutting himself in, Jim reopens the door.
See? Just take some good old Yankee know-how.
It's possible, darling. The lock works for you and not for Bill.
What happened?
He shuts the door on all of them.
Now go ahead, dear. Just open the door.
Muriel grasps the knob and pushes. Rolling her eyes, she grips it and turns with the full force of her arm.
Well, I don't seem to be able to...
Well, it's perfectly simple. You just take the knob and turn it clockwise.
Jim butts his shoulder and hip against the wooden door. Muriel and Bill exchange a snide glance. As Jim struggles with the door, Bill leans against the back wall and takes his pipe from his mouth.
Nothing like that good old Yankee know-how.
Jim pounds with his fist. Bill looks out a window of the open frame house.
Uh-oh.
The last of the workmen leaves in his car. A cloud of dust drifts over Jim's lone convertible.
Oh, dear.
Bill settles back down on a nail keg, crosses his arms, and props up his feet. Jim strides to the window and surveys the scene outside.
If I could just get over to that scaffolding.
Sizing up the sturdy window frame, he jiggles it, then lightly tests the pane dividers against his fist. He shrugs.
Well, seems a shame, but I guess it's the only way to do it.
What are you going to do?
Well, don't get panicky, dear. I'll get you out of here. Don't worry. Stand up, Bill.
Huh?
Hold that over the window.
He hands Bill a sheet of tar paper.
Stand back, Muriel.
Holding a thick cardboard cylinder, Jim rams the window.
Roger.
He does a double take as the locked door slowly drifts open. His high forehead creasing, he shoots a glance at Muriel, who turns to Bill.
In case of emergency, break glass. Come on, Bill.
Jim glowers as they leave the closet and shakes his head at the faulty doorknob.
That's funny. There's no reason why that shouldn't work.
Going downstairs, Bill ducks under the floor joists. Upstairs, the storeroom door is closed again. Bill and Muriel share a glance, then head back up. Later in New York, Gussie squeezes around the crowded dining table to serve Jim.
Wham again.
Yes, sir?
Muriel, I thought we'd agree.
Gussie, from now on, no more wham for Mr. Blanding.
What about the rest of us?
Gussie, I'm sure there are other substitutes, bacon, sausages, or something
like that. The children like wham.
Well, there must be other things.
Mrs. Blanding likes it, too.
But just the same.
And I consider it very tasty.
Gussie, I spend 8 hours every day trying to cram this stuff down the throats of 100 million people. I know all about it. It's succulent goodness. It's sugar-smoked tenderness. It's...
You don't have to sell me. I like it.
Joan comes to the table with a magazine and the morning mail.
Oh, thank you.
Just Bill's.
Darling, I'm going out to the place this afternoon. Bill's driving me up to see about the landscaping.
Well, that'll be nice. What do you mean, Bill's driving you?
Why do you always say, what do you mean, when you know perfectly well what I mean and what you mean?
I mean, the moment I turn my back, Bill Cole's driving you someplace or something.
He's only being helpful.
I thought he was a lawyer. Why isn't he out suing somebody?
Baker, Baker, Baker.
Jim opens a letter.
Hmm. Well, we'll just see about that.
What is it?
Muriel follows him to the living room where he dials the phone.
What's the matter, Jim?
Mr. William Cole, please. Hello, Bill. They can't get away with this. I know my rights as a citizen. Why, this notice from the owner of this building. Yeah, he wants our apartment. He's ordering us to move in 30 days. Well, that's ridiculous. How can I move into a house that isn't even finished? Well, there are no windows, no plaster, no paint.
The girls pass through with the birdcage.
I have no intention of moving in 30 days. This is not legal. I'm going to fight this thing, and I don't care if it takes every penny I've got. Yeah. 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 All right.
Well?
We're moving in 30 days.
Later, moving vans cross the covered bridge.
So came 30 days, and they moved.
Gussie and Bill ride behind in an open trailer.
That is, we moved.
Now the finished home.
Well, there she is, bright and shining, and just about complete. The residence of Mr. and Mrs. James Blanding.
Joan jumps out of the car.
All right, everybody out.
Jim and Muriel beam.
Guess you can't blame them for feeling just a little bit proud.
The girls unload the birdcage.
Even Theodore's proud.
Jim beckons the movers.
All right, come on, men. Let's have a little action here. Okay, Mac.
Jim escorts Muriel up the sloping front lawn past a low stone wall.
The big moment. Oh, look, he wants to carry her across the threshold. Isn't that romantic?
The girls scowl as Jim scoops their mother into his arms.
What's that sacroiliac? 15 years since you've done this sort of thing. Nice work, Tarzan. Now let's see if you can make it into the living room. That's right, go right in. Don't pay any attention to the sign.
It says, wet varnish.
Why don't you look where you're going? Can't you see I'm varnishing this floor?
A workman throws down his brush.
Stop painting that floor and put some planks down in here or something. Okay, Mac, okay, but take it easy. The Republicans ain't in yet, you know.
The workman steps on his own wet varnish. He dashes his hat to the floor. In the hallway, Jim sets Muriel down.
There. I'll just see Sims about this. Oh, Father, will you see what we found?
His daughters beckon him outside.
Now what?
Empty window frames.
Oh, fine. No windows. Well, we'll just see Sims about that, too.
Jim finds the brawny foreman.
Where's Sims?
Around back, trying to figure out what to do about them windows.
What's the problem? You put windows up.
Not these. They don't fit.
Oh, they don't they?
He finds Retch with Sims.
Oh, Mr. Blandings, you better take a look at these bills.
What's this about the windows?
I'm afraid there's been a little slip-up. These windows seem to belong to a Mr. Landing in Fishkill. I spoke to him on the phone this morning.
Well, has he got mine?
No. He seems to have some windows that belong to a Mr. Blandsworth in Peekskill.
Where are my windows?
Well, as near as we can find out, they've either been sent to a Mr. Banning in Danbury or a Mr. Bamberger in Waterbury.
Bill joins them.
What are we supposed to do? Spend the rest of our lives in a house without windows?
It'll only be a matter of a few days.
What's a Zuz water softener?
How should I know?
You've got one.
He shows Jim the invoice.
Furnishing and installing one Zuz water softener, $285. I didn't order that.
I'm afraid I authorized that, Mr. Blandings. Save your boiler and water pipes.
From what?
Rust. The plumber assures me that the water in your well is the most corrosive in its entire experience in the trade.
Another first.
Well, if it's necessary, put it in. We're moving in today.
It's in.
Oh, then get me the bill for it.
You've got it.
Well, all right then.
Later, the moving vans drive away, their empty trailers rocking as they turn onto the road. In the house, Muriel, in trousers and soft shoes, supervises workmen.
That's right, upstairs and in the bedroom.
Mother!
That'll be fine.
The moving vans just left and we went.
Never mind, you two go and help Gussie in the kitchen. Now, Mr. Padelford, we'll talk about the painting.
Okay.
I had some samples.
She finds a stack of fabric swatches.
Here we are. Now, first the living room. I want it to be a soft green.
Uh-huh.
Not as blue-green as a robin's egg.
No.
But not as yellow-green as daffodil buds.
Uh-huh.
Now, the only sample I could get is a little too yellow. But don't let whoever does it go to the other extreme and get it too blue.
No.
It should just be a sort of grayish-yellow-green.
Uh-huh.
Now, the dining room. I'd like yellow. Not just yellow, a very gay yellow. Something bright and sunshiny.
Uh-huh.
I tell you, Mr. Padelford, if you'll send one of your workmen to the grocer for a pound of their best butter and match that exactly, you can't go wrong.
Uh-huh.
Now, this is the paper we're going to use in the hall. It's flowered, but I don't want the ceiling to match any of the colors of the flowers.
No.
There's some little dots in the background, and it's these dots I want you to match. Not the little greenish dot near the hollyhock leaf.
No.
But the little bluish dot between the rosebud and the delphinium blossom. Is that clear?
Uh-huh.
Now, the kitchen's to be white. Not a cold, antiseptic hospital white.
No.
A little warmer, but still not to suggest any other color but white.
Uh-huh.
Now, for the powder room, in here, I want you to match this thread, and don't lose it. It's the only spool I have, and I had an awful time finding it. As you can see, it's practically an apple red, somewhere between a healthy wine sap and an unripened Jonathan.
Uh-huh.
Oh, excuse me.
Padelford turns to an assistant.
You got that, Charlie?
Red, green, blue, yellow, white.
Check.
In the kitchen, Gussie directs Muriel to Joan, bending over a pile of broken china.
Oh, Joan.
I'm awful sorry.
You knew Father was supposed to carry the heavy things.
Well, Father disappeared. I haven't seen him for an hour.
Where's Uncle Bill, Mother? He's going to miss his train.
If they've run off somewhere, it certainly isn't very... Heavens.
Muriel opens the upstairs storeroom door. Inside, Jim and Bill sit pounding the floor with a paper roll and a nail keg.
I thought you were going to take care of it.
I thought you were.
You're going to miss your train, Uncle Bill. It leaves Lansdale in 25 minutes.
I kind of hate to leave this little place. Just four walls and a couple of nail kegs, but to me it'll always be home.
Bill takes the train schedule.
Isn't there a later one?
Not till the commuter special, tomorrow morning at 6:15.
You mean 7:15?
No, Dad, 6:15.
What about the 7:15 I'm supposed to take to the office every morning?
There's a little asterisk. The 7:15 runs only Saturdays, Sundays, and holidays.
What? Bill, let me see that.
Jim scans the timetable, then clamps his lips.
Muriel.
Oh, dear, don't tell me I read it wrong.
That's fine. For the rest of my life, I'll have to get up at 5 in the morning to catch the 6:15 to get to my office at 8. It doesn't even open until 9, and I never get there until 10.
Well, maybe if you start earlier, you can leave the office earlier.
To get home earlier, to get to bed earlier, to get up earlier, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you can get the railroad to push the train up to 4:15. Then you won't have to go to bed at all.
You're going to miss your train, Uncle Bill.
I'll drive you to the station.
But I can drive him.
No, dear, you'd better save your strength. You have to get up at 5.
Later, Muriel drives the convertible down a hard-packed road. Bill sits beside her, his pipe in his mouth.
It would be nice if you could spend your vacation up here, Bill.
Mm-hmm. We'll see how things work out at the office.
I tell you, I'll scout around and see if I can find you a cottage in Lansdale.
Well, if you can't find me a cottage, I can always move back into that closet.
Back at the house, Betsy and Joan unpack crates in the living room while Jim backs away from a smoky fireplace and bumps into Joan.
Oh! Father!
Now look what you've done.
As he waves the soutière, Betsy calmly turns a knob on the mantle. The smoke goes up the chimney.
Father, the first principle of lighting a fire is to see if the flue is open. A 3-year-old child knows that.
Next time we want a fire, I'll send out for a 3-year-old child. Now, get that stuff cleaned up and then go on in and help Gussie set the table. It's getting late.
Joan cleans up the mess.
Look, Dad, your fraternity pins.
Pins? I only had one.
There are two of them here.
All right, just put them away.
Funny, this one says WC on the back of it. WC. William Cole. It must be Uncle Bill.
Let me see that.
Betsy sits cross-legged on the floor and reads from a book with gilt pages and a locking clasp.
What's that? It's Mother's diary while she was in college. It's slightly tarred.
Let's see.
That's none of your business.
I'd say Mother and Uncle Bill were somewhat of an item.
People do not read other people's diaries. That's not a very nice thing to do. Now go in there and help Gussie with the table. Come on, shoot.
What about...
I'll take care of the shoe.
With a cautious look after the girls, Jim opens the diary. Later in the master bathroom, he shaves in a dark overcoat. Muriel squeezes in between him and the mirror, wearing a winter coat over a pair of Jim's pajamas.
Excuse.
As Muriel swings open the mirrored medicine cabinet, Jim tries to follow his reflection. Shaving in quick strokes, he maneuvers behind Muriel as she blocks his view.
Muriel, do you have to do that now?
There's no need to be so irritable just because you have to shave at night.
I'm not irritable.
Well, you're something. You haven't said a civil word all evening.
Sometimes a man doesn't feel like talking.
What is it, dear? Something down at the office?
No.
You got the new slogan for Wham?
It's not due yet.
It's something. You're certainly upset about something. I can always tell.
I'm not upset. It's just that I don't happen to approve of falsehood and deception, particularly in my own wife.
What are you talking about?
Oh, nothing.
He shaves his cleft chin.
It's just that I distinctly remember you're telling me you gave Bill back his fraternity pin 15 years ago.
What?
But did you or didn't you?
Did I or didn't I what?
Give it back to him.
Well, of course I did. If I said I did, I did.
He narrows his eyes.
Then perhaps you'll have the goodness to explain how this happened to fall out of your jewel box.
He shoves the snap-sized fraternity pin under her gaze. Jim's dark eyes glare.
What's so funny?
You? You're jealous!
He strides from the bathroom after her.
If you were so crazy about the guy, why didn't you marry him?
Because I wasn't in love with him.
That's not what you said in your diary.
Oh! Now you've been reading my diary.
Well, it just happened to fall open. And I happened to look at it. It just happened.
I'll just bet.
It's all over the book.
Shh, the children.
Then why don't you admit it? You were in love with Bill Cole.
Oh, don't be absurd. Of course I was in love with Bill. In those days, I was in love with a new man every week.
Yeah, why did you marry me?
I'm beginning to wonder. Maybe it was those big cow eyes of yours with that ridiculous hole in your chin. Maybe I knew you were going to bring me out to this $38,000 icebox with a dried-up trout stream and no windows. Or maybe I just happened to fall in love with you, but for heaven's sakes, don't ask me why.
By the bedroom fireplace, Muriel plugs the alarm clock into a wall outlet, while Jim wipes his smooth cheeks with a towel. His wife heaves a deep sigh as he approaches behind her.
Muriel.
What time is it?
9:20.
Thank you.
Muriel, would it do any good to say I'm sorry?
I don't know.
Well, I am.
She puts the clock on a mantelpiece.
I behaved like a schoolboy, and I'm sorry.
Muriel throws her arms around him.
Oh, Jim.
They kiss, exchange a tender glance, then cuddle their cheeks together. Muriel smiles at a glob of foam on Jim's ear.
Why don't you take the soap out of your ears?
Why do I love you so much?
As he softly kisses her, she locks her hands around his broad shoulders. He clutches her more tightly.
Darling, it's awfully late.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you ought to go down and lock the doors.
What for? The windows are all open anyway.
He nuzzles her neck.
You have to get up at 5 o'clock.
Jim tenses, then slowly pulls away.
Yeah, I guess so.
Muriel tilts her chin to stare into his dark eyes.
Good night.
Good night.
They share a quick peck, then sink down, still in each other's arms, to their twin mattresses on the floor. They pull up their neatly tucked blankets over their coats, then Jim turns out the light. Later, a rainstorm batters a Manhattan skyscraper.
So the days sped by, and the bills, and the extras. And as autumn reared its lovely head, so did the deadline for Jim's slogan. It was practically a photo finish.
Jim turns as Mary enters his office.
You better send out for sandwiches and coffee. It looks like an all-night session.
What did Mr. Dascombe say?
He said, Blandings, I want that slogan on my desk by 9 a.m. Check? I said, check.
Well, I guess you'll just have to dream something up, good or bad.
I rather got the impression that it better be good.
He gazes outside.
Funny how you look forward to the little things. Rain, for instance.
He sits in a leather chair.
For a month now, I've been looking forward to the first rainy night at the house.
A vision of Muriel appears beside him.
Muriel pouring coffee.
He settles back.
Me in my new smoking jacket. With my pipe and slippers. Reading my newspaper.
His vision of Muriel becomes real at the house with Bill by the fire.
You suppose my clothes are dry yet?
He wears the smoking jacket.
Thank heavens, the children.
Muriel walks through the foyer in a lounging robe which sweeps the floor. On the doorstep stands a puny man in a soaked rain slicker.
What a night. I'm Harry Selby from down the road.
Won't you come in?
Oh, thank you. I'm afraid I'm going to get your place all wet. I just came in to tell you that the kids are safe, Mr. Blandings.
Oh, I'm not Mr. Blandings. Cole's the name. Bill Cole. Friend of the family. Just came in out of the rain.
I'm Mrs. Blandings.
Oh, how do?
He smiles stiffly.
No, Mrs. Williams just called and says your phone is out of order. She wanted me to come over and tell you that the water's rising. They've got the bridge roped off. Your girls will spend the night over at her place.
Oh, thank you. I was beginning to get quite worried.
Oh, she'll take good care of them.
May I give you a cup of coffee?
Oh, no, thank you. I'd better be getting back before I have to swim for it. Well, night, Mrs. Blandings.
Good night. I'm very grateful.
Oh, not at all. Night, Mr.
Cole, Bill Cole, friend of the family. Just came in out of the rain.
Selby cocks an eyebrow.
Well, night.
Good night, and thank you.
Muriel returns to the living room, and Bill joins her on the sofa.
No bridge.
That's fine.
How do I get back to Lansdale?
You just have to spend the night here.
Well, Muriel, really? Your husband in New York and your children away? Think of my reputation.
Don't worry, Snow White.
You will be just as pure and unsullied in the morning as you were the night before.
That's the story of my life.
Now, in Jim's disorderly office, Mary sleeps in a chair with her suit jacket pillowed under her head. As Jim pulls open his window blinds, a stream of sunshine bursts in and stirs her awake. She lifts her head and blinks. Jim sits stiffly on the couch, then fishes through an ashtray. Finding an inch-long butt, he smooths it and strikes a match. The flame leaps as he inhales, singeing his nose. A rumpled paper on the cushion beside him catches his attention. As he reads it, he snaps his fingers. Mary lifts her head.
Compare the price. Compare the slice. Take our advice by Wham!
Mary shakes her head distastefully, then closes her eyes.
Oh.
Jim stretches his long legs over the back of the sofa. Loosening his necktie, he tugs the knot over his chin onto the bridge of his nose, then flips the long tie end over his forehead. He stares across the room. Blinking, he rouses. Mary stirs again.
If you'd buy better ham, you'd better buy Wham.
Spoiled petroleum. If you'd buy better oil, you'd better buy boil.
Jim idly picks up one of the rejected notes beneath him. The once-wadded paper is a mass of creases, which he strains to read around the knot between his eyes. He pulls his tie back down against his shirt. Getting up, he scoots over to Mary and ceremonially holds up the paper.
This little piggy went to market, as meek and as mild as a lamb. He smiled in his tracks. When they slipped him the axe, he knew he'd turn out to be Wham.
She sends him a frightened stare.
He knew he'd turn out to be Wham. It's gone. I've lost my touch. Oh, well, maybe I never had a touch. Who knows? I can't think anymore. All I've got on my mind is a house with an $18,000 mortgage. And then bills and extras and antiques and then... Oh, I don't know.
He wanders behind his desk and sits down. His gaze falls on a framed picture of Muriel and another photo of their daughters. He bolts for his coat by the door. Mary stands up.
Where are you going?
I'm going home to get some sleep, and I'd advise you to do the same.
But you haven't...
Of course I have, but this isn't the only job in town.
Well, what'll I tell Mr. Dascombe?
Oh, just tell him.
Later, a taxicab arrives at the Blandings' home and stops in their rain-slicked driveway. Jim steps out wearily. His gaze drifts to a wood-paneled station wagon parked on the paved slope. Fiddling with his keys, he strides up the grass beside the flagstone walk. The morning sun casts his tall shadow against the stark white front door. Inside, Muriel meets with Henry Sims.
I'm sorry Jim isn't here.
Oh, that's quite all right. I was on my way to town anyway. Thought I might catch Jim before he left for the office.
Sure you won't stay to breakfast?
No, thanks very much. All the same.
Jim comes in.
Good morning, dear.
You must be exhausted. How'd it go?
Fine.
Everything all right?
Everything's fine.
He notices Sims.
Oh, hello, Henry. What are you doing out with the morning dew?
Just dropped in to check the blueprints. Some extras came in from Rest this morning, and there are a couple of things I thought we ought to go over together.
Really? What are they?
Well, let's see. A few things here that are all right, I guess.
He reads invoices.
Mortising 5 butts. $1.98.
Well, let's not quibble about it. A man's entitled to mortise a few butts now and then.
Extra hardware, $3.89.
Petty larceny, but let him get away with it.
Now, there's one here that, frankly, I don't understand. Here we are. Changes in closet, $1,247. Did you authorize that?
Well, we probably told him to... 1,200 and what?
$47, changes in closet.
That's the end.
He snatches it from Sims.
What's this notation? Refer to detail sheet 135. What's that?
As near as I can remember, that's something in back of the house. Let's take a look.
They unroll the blueprints on the coffee table.
It isn't a closet at all. It's off the back pantry.
Mrs. Blanding's little flower sink.
The men look at each other, then at Muriel.
Oh, Mrs. Blanding's little flower sink. You didn't authorize any changes, did you?
Well, they certainly weren't changes.
What have you done?
I haven't done anything. All I did was just nothing at all.
Jim stands and folds his arms.
What have you done?
Well, all I did was one day I saw four pieces of flagstone left over from the porch that were just going to be thrown away because nobody wanted them, and I asked Mr. Retch if he wouldn't just put them down on the floor of the flower room and poke a little cement between the cracks and give me a nice stone floor where it might be wet with flowers and things. That's absolutely all I did.
That's all you did?
Absolutely. Just four little pieces of flagstone.
Did you, by any chance, authorize a drain?
Of course I didn't. All I said was that I wanted a nice, dry stone floor. And Mr. Retch was just as nice as he could be and said, well, you're the doctor. And that was all that anybody said to anybody about anything.
Well, I think I can tell you what happened. First, the carpenters had to rip up the flooring that was already laid. Those planks run under the entire width of the pantry, so Retch had to knock out the bottom of the pantry wall to get at them. Then, he had to chop off the top of the joist under the flower sink space to make room for the cradle. Or, I guess he got some iron straps and fastened them to a large pan to give him something to hold the cement. And then, with that added load on the weakened joist, I'll bet he had to put a lally column down there for support, too.
But it was just four little flagstones, and I...
Quiet! The main solar pipe runs under there on wall brackets. So Retch had to get the plumber back, take out a section, so that he could get that cradle set. And I'll bet he had to change the pitch of the solar pipe from one end of the house to the other. Good morning, Mr. Cole.
Morning. Morning, Jim. Morning, Jim.
Hello, Bill.
Jim's eyes open wide. Standing tall, he scrutinizes Bill, who wears Jim's striped bathrobe.
I bet my bottom
dollar... The bridge is roofed off, and Bill had to stay here last night.
Slept like a rock.
Rip out about 60 feet of armored cable between the main panel and the junction box by the oil burner, including the 220-volt cable that goes to the stove.
Morning, everybody! Wow, what a night. I've never seen so much rain in all my natural life.
Gussie spent the night in Lansdale.
I passed the girls over at the Williamses. They'll be on any minute.
Thank you, Gussie. You better get breakfast started.
Jim stares at Gussie, then Bill, then Muriel.
Where were we?
We were at the 220-volt cable that goes to the stove.
And, of course, there are hot and cold water pipes hooked to the joist right under
that
pantry.
Just a minute. You mean the children weren't here last night either?
How could they be? The bridge was closed.
I just came across it.
It was closed last night.
It's open now.
Well, if you'll all excuse me, I think I'll just go upstairs and slip into something a little more comfortable.
Muriel fidgets under Jim's severe stare.
Well, I guess that's about the size of it, except that Retch had to repair the pantry wall. That meant getting a plasterer back, and he couldn't possibly have broken through that wall without...
All right, Henry, all right, we'll take care of it.
Oh, I'll admit it's a little steep, but I'll try and get Retch to knock $100 off the bill. If I can't get that, I'll certainly try for 75.
Jim keeps his eyes locked on Muriel.
I'll make a stab at 50.
You do that.
Sim shows himself to the door.
Anyhow, I'm almost sure we can get 25.
Muriel's moist eyes plead with her husband.
Good day.
Good day.
Bye.
Jim backs away as she reaches for him.
Darling, you're upset.
He brandishes the
You've
rolled blueprints.
On your mind.
Muriel, there's only one thing I've got on my mind. This house and how soon we can get rid of it.
That's not what you're thinking.
Maybe it's not. Maybe I'm thinking I was once a happy man. I didn't have a closet. I didn't have three bathrooms. But I did have my sanity, a few dollars in the bank, two children who loved me, and a wife I could trust.
That's a fine thing to say.
I also had a job at Dascombe and Banton, something I don't happen to have at the moment.
Jim!
That's right, I've resigned. We're starting all over again from scratch. And without this house...
You love this house.
I hate it, from its rabbited lintels to its Zuzza's water softener.
You know you don't mean that.
Every word of it. Anybody who builds a house today is crazy. The minute you start, they put you on the list. The all-American sucker list. You start out to build a home and you wind up in a poorhouse. And if it can happen to me, what about the fellows who aren't making $15,000 a year? What about the kids who just got married and want a home of their own? It's a conspiracy, I tell you. A conspiracy against every boy and girl who were ever in love. What do you want?
It's Mr. Chisander, wearing a dark suit and tie.
Mr. Blandings, there's a matter of $12.36.
$12.36.
Why be a piker, Mr. Desander? Here, take everything I've got, spread it out amongst your pals. Perhaps Wretch would like a little something. Maybe Zuka could use my new smoking jacket. It's open house, Mr. Desander. Help yourself.
Now, hold on, Mr. Blandings. This $12.36 you don't owe me. I owe you.
Jim stares at him.
What was that?
Yeah. Found overcharge here. Almost 3 feet.
He shakes some money from a wrapper.
Better count it. Think it's all there.
Thank you very much, Mr. Desander.
Muriel smiles warmly.
Well, guess I better be going. You sure got a pretty place here. Take good care of it.
Muriel eyes Jim as he watches Tassander go.
Oh, I'll tell Mr. Zucker about the smoking jacket.
Muriel's polite smile fades as she looks into Jim's baggy eyes.
Darling, what did you mean? Are we really going to have to sell this house?
Don't know, dear. Don't know anything anymore.
Bill rejoins them.
In case anyone's interested, I'm leaving for town.
He opens a window.
Oh, Mr. Tassander, could you give me a lift into Lansdale?
Yep.
Fine, I'll be right with you.
Turning, he faces Jim.
If you want to count the silverware, I'll wait.
Be patient with me, Bill. Maybe one of these days I'll grow up.
What happened to him?
$12.36.
You mind if I say something? You know, ever since this thing started, I've been the voice of doom about the whole project. Every step of the way, I've been firmly convinced that you were getting fleeced, bilked, rooked, flim-flammed, and generally taken to the cleaners. Well, maybe you were. Maybe it cost you a lot more than you thought it would. Maybe there were times when you wish you'd never started the whole thing. But when I look around at what you two have got here, well, I don't know. Maybe there are some things you should buy with your heart, not your head.
Grinning, Jim straightens.
Maybe those are the things that really count.
They shake hands.
Well, see you around. Bye, Deb.
Squeezing Muriel's arm, Bill kisses her on the cheek and leaves. Jim sighs contentedly, then his forehead creases as he replays the handshake. Now in the yard.
Office.
Well, I'm on a kind of vacation.
You mean you got fired?
No, not exactly.
Come and get it, everybody. Breakfast is ready.
Oh, good. I'm starving. What are we having, Gussie?
Orange juice, scrambled eggs, and you know what?
Ham?
Not ham, wham. If you ain't eating wham, you ain't eating ham.
Jim's eyes flash. He lifts his wife off her feet.
Darling, give Gussie a $10 raise.
Later, Gussie appears in a magazine ad with her slogan. Jim, in a lawn chair, opens a book entitled Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House. He smiles at us.
Drop in and see us sometime.
Yeah, do that.
Bill fills his pipe and sits with the Blandings on their manicured lawn. Betsy and Joan run playfully up the slope to the house where Gussie works outside. A title appears in ornate script. The End. Credits appear. Cast of characters: Cary Grant as Jim, Myrna Loy as Muriel, Melvin Douglas as Bill, Reginald Denny as Sims, Sharon Moffat as Joan, Connie Marshall as Betsy, Louise Beavers as Gussie, Ian Wolfe as Smith, Harry Shannon as Tassander, Tito Vuolo as Zuko, Nestor Paiva as Apollonio, Jason Robards as Wretch, Lorene Tuttle as Mary.